Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Marty Oakley with PBJ Gazette Online, and this is TS Radio. And Thomas, stop whatever you're doing because we can hear it. Our show tonight is Whistleblowers, and it's brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblowers Summit. That'll take place in Washington, D.C., July 30th and 31st, and the public is cordially invited. Our guest tonight was supposed to be Carolyn Douglas, who had to beg off. She wasn't able to make it, so standing in for her is one of my favorite people, and that's Thomas Rainey. And we've had Thomas on before, and the conversation just happens to go everywhere and all over the place because we talk about everything. So tonight, we're going to be talking about the Freedman speech from, I believe, didn't you tell me, Thomas, 1961?
Yes, it's Benjamin H. Friedman, 1961
yes.
Speech at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C.
Okay, and so we're going to be covering that tonight and talking about that, and I apologize, I know a lot of you were waiting for Carolyn to come on and talk about judicial discretion, but apparently that's not going to work out. Okay, Thomas, the last time I had you on, we talked about the creeping genocide in this country. And one of the things, and this is happening right before our eyes, and I borne out the other day on C-SPAN, the actuarials for Social Security were on there. They were noting the disastrous drop in the birth rate in this country. It's down to 42% of what it was 10 to 15 years ago. Canada is reflecting the same thing, and of course they have the same vaccine schedule we do, and vaccines are intended to make you infertile. Whatever else you think they do, that's their intent. So she's talking about that. Then she turned around and immediately highlighted the uptick, which was massive, in the mortality rate of the elderly, which they didn't anticipate. Now, so you've got an elder community that is leaving faster than they thought for reasons we could go into, but we won't on this show. This is intentional. And we have the intentional suppression of the fertility rate. The woman comes right in behind that and talks about how the population has expanded 35 to 40 million over that same period of time. What they are doing is suppressing fertility, and then they're euthanizing the elderly at a rate I can't even believe, and they don't care if you know it or you don't, and they are bringing in a replacement population. And one of the reasons Thomas and I agree on is that they're getting away with this is how society in this country has devolved, how it is immoral, it's absolutely in the tank. And you can take this from several different avenues. Thomas brought up this speech by Friedman. So, Thomas, I'm going to let you take it from there and talk about what this man covered.
Well, basically what he did is he told us what's going to happen to us and that World War III was already decided some time ago. I'd like to mention one thing that Dr. Frances Cress Wilson brought out back in the early 70s or late 1969. She also predicted Bush would be elected president in December 2015. What she talked about is that most people don't think about the fact that there is only one race, the human race, which has been divided into two races, one white and one black. And that Judaism is not a race, it's a religion.
Yes.
Most of us never think about that. You know, the American people have been so dumbed down that if you can't tell them a story to young people that lasts more than 10 minutes.
Right.
So you have to break it up in bits of 10 minutes at a time. And what Friedman talked about was that he was a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
He's no longer one.
He
talked about sitting in the meeting in 1903, I think it was. What the plan was then. They had already chosen Palestine for the Israeli Jewish population. He talked about Senator Kennedy going to New York, making a speech about how he was going to use American voice to protect these people who are going to take over in Palestine, and that he was going to defend them with American Christians. I guess the
wow.
Christians in Palestine who would be fighting against them, and the American people never stopped to think about that. What I wanted to also mention is this, what I've been thinking about more and more each day. They said 22 veterans commit suicide every day. I don't
mm-hmm.
believe it.
I don't either.
I think that the medications that they're giving them is killing them. How many people die from OxyContin every day?
Mm-mm.
How many people die from suicides every day?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the majority race of these people? This is our white brothers and sisters. There's a slow genocide against them, and many of them
yes.
don't get it. They are so infused with love and the flag, they don't understand how they're being used to deny their own true value of what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was only primarily when I grew up, there was just black people and white people. While everything was segregated, we each had our own community going about our own way, and most of us got along.
Mm-hmm.
There was only a few people coming from the masses at the top. But the same people own the banks then, own the banks now. And they're always crying about how they suffered. The Balfour Agreement was this agreement where Great Britain was supposed to provide the land for homeland for the Jews, even Germany and wherever else. Now, it wasn't, England did not own that land, but they signed the agreement to give it to them as a homeland. That was what was in Benjamin H. Friedman's speech. He goes into much more detail. I haven't listened to it now in probably a year. But I wanted to point out what we see happening right now that most people don't get. We are being entertained. They wanted to keep us entertained and fat, fed and entertained. That way we can't see what's really happened to us. And then divide us by having us fight each other. Slaves
yes.
fighting slaves.
Mm-hmm.
This is what David Icke talks about in the Agenda 21. Most people don't know what that is. Agenda 21, Agenda 2030.
Yeah.
If you watch the Hunger Games, it gives
uh-huh.
you an idea of how we're being manipulated. When I grew up, the majority race was white. The second majority was black. Now, the majority, second group, is Hispanic. And they say in 20, 30 years, the blacks will be not second group or third group, but the fourth group because the Asians are going to take over.
Yeah.
They are the replacements
yes.
for the whites and the blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Who are being genocided right on out. And the owner of Microsoft tells you how they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He has this formula of how you're going to reduce the population. They not only put it there for us, they put it in stone at the Georgia Guidestones.
Yes, I've seen those, Thomas, in person. I've seen those. They are
oh,
massive.
Oh, you have?
Yes, I have.
You know they have updated it recently.
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'll be down there at the end of July before the summit, and I'll go have my son run me up there so I can see it again. But, yeah, I saw them many years ago when I lived down there, and they're in Edmonton, Georgia, and they
mm-hmm.
are massive, absolutely massive stones, and they have a dolmen on top that holds them in place. And it's, what is it, 2, 4, 6, 8 different languages.
Right, 8 languages.
Yes, and they were the 8 most common languages in the world at the time. And so they, I don't know how they could have changed them. I'll be interested in seeing that. But go ahead, Thomas.
There's a little corner block that they took out of the top. At the very top of that, they cut out a square and put a date on it, which was not there before. But at any rate, what we don't realize is they talk about the population going to over 7 billion, and they want to reduce it down to 500 million.
Yeah.
Now, America has right now got troops in, what, 76 countries fighting?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that?
No.
Why we can't have health care is because we spend too much money in kill care.
Mm-hmm.
But who is the killing for?
Yes.
You have to always understand who benefits from this. Every time a gun goes bang, bang, the cash register goes ching, ching for somebody who owns all these war machines. You know, I mean, I remember a program was done about 10 or 15 years ago about how much money each of the war-making companies were making. And they were making more money than the 9th richest country in this world. Can you imagine that? It's
a
money-making machine. And then when the veterans get out now, I have friends of mine that served in Vietnam, not only friends but family, and I know this personally. They suffered what they call some Agent Orange. They denied it. They couldn't get their benefits, some of them, until this year, 50 years later. The new young vets are saying the Veteran Administration's motto is delay, delay, deny. We hope you die.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I'd had Denise Cauldron on. She wrote a book about that, and it's called Stall, Deny, and Hope They Die. And it was all about what they call the hamster wheel inside the VA. And they have no intentions of paying any benefits. And they,
like Social
these
Security.
Waitlists, yeah, yeah. And they have no intentions of paying anything. Hey, hold on just a second here. I think Carolyn... Let's see. Might be on. Hold on a second here.
Sure.
Hi, this is Marty.
Hi, this is Carolyn Douglas.
Carolyn, thank you for calling in. Thomas, you want to stay on with us?
Sure, I'll hold on.
Okay.
Thomas has some amazing statistics, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Ooh, good heavens.
Last time I looked, I thought we had only invaded 57 countries. Are you saying, Thomas, that America has, in its imperial rule, invaded over 70 countries now?
We have
in 2018?
We have troops in 77 countries.
Yes. We currently...
Remember that
we're like the world's... What are we? The world's...
Terrorists. In Africa, we currently...
Number one terrorist
on
the planet.
We are. We are a terrorist nation. We have 100 armed conflicts going on right now just in Africa. In 2013, Hillary Clinton, in May, was at the Military Industrial Contractors Convention. And she's telling them that if they want to make money, they need to get their contracting done now to get on the ground floor. She said, and this was at that time, she said, at this point in time, she said, we're involved in 94 armed conflicts that the American public knows nothing about. And I thought, what? And
well,
Thomas,
I think they're
right.
Doing it by executive order sometimes. You know, they're circumventing the whole war powers where Congress, if we're in another country for so many days, I think it's 90 days, then Congress is supposed to take a vote. But now they're using, the executive office is using executive power. Plus, we also have a fair number of wars that I think are CIA-driven.
Yes.
And the intervention is done in this secret. It's almost like a fourth branch of government.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's an extension of the executive branch, but it certainly isn't legislative. I mean, the military has a presence in our economy and in the globe that simply isn't provided for in the U.S. Constitution.
No, it isn't. But the thing of it is, Carolyn, they have dismantled us. They've been doing it for 25 years. Our manufacturing sector is virtually non-existent. We make nothing. And everything is shipped in. So they have to keep the economy running, because if it collapses, then we're going to know what kind of crap we're actually in. So our whole economy is predicated on war. It's what drives everything. And we
so
have
it's
become,
almost like we switched our economic and manufacturing base
yes.
over
yes.
to, I think they thought it was going to be high tech, but they did it by, I remember the World Trade Organization riots.
Mm-hmm.
Weren't they in
yes.
Seattle?
Yes.
When they took down all the tariff barriers that protected American workers.
Yes.
And it gutted American manufacturing.
Yep.
And they've switched in with this high tech revolution, but that seems to be kind of an artificial bubble, an economic
yes.
bubble, where certain people have these artificial enormous profits from
mm-hmm.
ideas that never get into anything. It's kind of like what
right.
Enron did. You know, at
yes.
the end, Enron was going to sell weather futures. Weather futures, what is that? That is nothing.
Yeah.
Right. That's like an idea. But and they scoop off the top layer of money, and that 1%, I think it's probably closer to 10%, but it
mm-hmm.
seems like it's been the rape of the American worker, the rape of
yep.
the American middle class. It's just suck the economics out. And
well,
the
yeah,
middle class
called-
people that I know work so hard and still continue to fall behind in terms of standard of living. It's happened
what you're
for
talking
two
about
decades
these unreal-
now.
Realized ideas. That's called mark-to-market. And what they did, somebody had come up with it, and this is what Enron did. It's they come up with a big idea, and they plan it all out on paper, project it all the way out, and if we do this, it should make X amount of dollars when we're done. Then they sell the idea as if it's a reality. This is what Enron did. They sold it as if it was in place, operational, and going gangbusters, and people invested, they made their money, that's where they got caught. But many companies were doing the same thing and still are. These are unrealized ideas. It's basically, well, we got this idea, and here's all the plans for it, and this is the money we anticipate making, so the stock is going to be worth X amount of dollars. And it's all hypothetical, but the money rolls in.
But
there are so many
different American industries that have done that kind of self-dealing,
yeah.
and it's ripping off the consumer, it's ripping off the worker, it's ripping off the American. Everyone is not that elite,
mm-hmm.
1%. Actually, I think it's closer to 10% at the
time.
And that elitism that has taken over America, I find, and you know I write about that, and I lecture about it, because that elitism has translated into cronyism in the court,
mm-hmm.
where people
yes.
who go to court for justice, they go to court for resolution of problems, find themselves raped in a similar way that
right.
the real estate bubble, the stock market
mm-hmm.
bubble, the Enron bubble, the the disease control. I mean, all of these different agencies that are all government extensions
yes.
End up taking without providing any product. There's no return. There's no return to the consumer. There's no return to the American system. And so they call it free enterprise, but it actually is an aberration of enterprise, because there's no labor. I mean, there's no work involved, no risk involved. It's kind of this mental process of scamming people Only it's done by a group of people that find they can hide behind corporations, or they can, you were talking about declaring war, or not declaring war, going into countries all over the globe, mm-hmm. because it's a money-making process.
Yes.
Have you ever considered how much it costs the United States to have all of those troops and all those ships circling and messing around with North Korea? Do you understand why the leader of North Korea is so frightened? We killed 4 million Koreans and were in the Korean War for no reason.
Right.
And yet if you study, if you look close at home, you see America has crumbling infrastructure all over the country. The infrastructure that was put in the early 1900s has never been maintained to the extent that it should have been, and mm-hmm. it's not being replaced because we're spending money and we're throwing money around the globe, but we're not satisfying our own American needs.
That's because we are building another empire that wants to destroy it so that it won't be in competition with them. And they attack us whenever they want to.
We have a message here. It says, we are stationed in 150 nations, and that count does not include the Navy or Marines at sea. And when going back to our talking about mark-to-market and the selling weather is called, that's selling heart protection money. It's called weather futures. And it mm-hmm. said, Enron understood, create the problem and sell the solution. There you go. The Hegelian dialectic brought to full fruit. But, yes, that is. Carolyn, we were going to talk tonight about judicial discretion. And we got a little late start here, but we're rolling. So I want to read from page 317 of your manual, The Dark Side, A Treatise on Law and Judging. And in there you say, and it's under the title of Individual Acts of Conscience, if a judge is biased, fails to make mandatory conflict disclosures, or is helping someone win a case, we've seen that happen, there is no effective remedy, no sanction, no downside. Judges and lawyers have a good thing going. They are making money, holding power, and crushing people for sport and retaliation. Their authority is from the system, not from a constitutional mandate or higher moral authority. I don't think I could have said that better myself if I'd have thought about it for 10 years. This thing about judicial discretion, I've seen that used as an excuse when some of the most egregious rulings have come off of these benches. What actually is judicial discretion?
It's wand waving. It's like the fairy godmother takes a wand and bops you on the head and little twinkly stars come out.
Oh.
I've also seen it in courtrooms where the judge makes a ruling and I would object, or I would get my objection on the record, and she would say, and I would give her the case law or the statute and say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, that's beyond your ability. You don't have that power in this court because the court is a limited jurisdiction. You only have power up to this dark line, and you can't cross over the line. And she says, because I said so. That's why this is the ruling, because I said so. Now, that's okay for mothers to say to 4-year-olds, but when you go to court and the judge makes an egregious error and you try to point it out and you try to make a record for appeal, because I said so is an exercise of discretion. Now, discretion is limited. Judges forget because they've been doing it for about 25 years, and they've expanded this artificial, because I said so, type of power. It's royalty, in essence. They think it traces back to the kings. And under common law, yes, it did. But in America, we had a revolution. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot happened, and we have a constitution. So this judicial discretion flies in the face of that. What the newest thing that I've seen, and it took me, it was only about 3 years ago, that I recognized that judges all over the country in every court are increasingly using judicial discretion as reasons for not just rulings along the way. You know, let's say you have a three-day trial and it takes a year and a half and perhaps you have a dozen hearings before you get to trial. And you lose and you lose and you lose. And it takes you a while. You walk out of the court and you feel disoriented. You feel fuzzy-brained and you think, something's not right here, but I can't put my finger on it. It may be that the judge is doing this wand-waving, and that's extremely useful if she is working with cronies, with friends, with attorneys who often appear in front of her. And I call it judicial cronyism, and it's a form of judicial corruption that's just rampant all over the country. Mm-hmm. But what I'm seeing is it's not just one or two things, and then they rule according to the statute. I used to draft bills for the state legislature, and those bills are hard law. They're written into law books. You can look them up. So if it says, you know, this, it doesn't make any difference what it is. If it says the speed limit is 55 miles an hour, she can, using her discretion, find that you violated a law because you were doing a different speed limit. She's ignoring the written law, but she doesn't have authority to do that. I'm using the pronoun because I often see it with females, but everyone, most judges do it often. And they do it more often when they're throwing a case for the attorneys and the insiders that are involved in the courtroom in that case, and they want to give them a favor. So when you line it up, I started a thought. What I've seen for the last 3 years is there are entire cases that are decided using no law, no statute, no constitutional principle, no rule, nothing. It's all whatever the judge feels like that day. Well, if you have a judge who's an alcoholic, if you have a judge who's impaired, if you have a judge who's a crony and is giving out favors to people in court, then they use discretion all the time. Now, here's the trick. Let's say you make a record. Let's say you lose. I think in one case that I was involved in and I was protesting because there was so much cronyism going on, the person on the other side told the newspaper that I lost 400 motions.
What?
Now, I wrote 400 motions in this case. I lost every single motion I ever brought. Now, I wrote the book on family law in that state. I knew the law. There's no way that I would be that dumb, that incompetent, that I would lose 400 out of 400. I mean,
wow.
What kind of an attorney would that be? It was so blatant. But they get blatant because when they're using discretion, this is the wild card. When it goes up on appeal, the Court of Appeals generally will not review a decision that was done with judicial discretion. They have certain pat phrases they use. So, so they say things like, we weren't present in the courtroom. We couldn't see the person's demeanor. Therefore, the judge has an edge, and we won't disturb a decision based on judicial discretion. We would only make a ruling if there was an error of law, like if you cited the law. But if the judge hasn't allowed you to say the law when you're in the courtroom or when you're at trial, the judge will not let you say what the law is because she doesn't want it to get in the way of her wand waving, of her ruling. So Court of Appeals won't let you win and overturn even an egregious error if it's done under abuse of discretion. So now what I'm finding is there's an epidemic in so many courts across the country where judges are ruling only using their discretion. which is like their wand waving. It's a return to an imperial way of thinking. And I find that across a lot of government, but it's really offensive when it covers an entire third branch of government, the entire judiciary. So if people aren't aware to look for it, if you've lost in court and it feels wrong and you want to deconstruct it, that's why I wrote that book. It has about 130 dirty tricks that judges do often. But this one is so egregious in an American system because it substitutes imperialism for the Constitution. So you have to go through and look at each of the rulings, and you'll see a pattern to it if you know to look for discretionary rulings where the judge just says, that's the way it is because I said so. You know, that kind of tone. Have you seen it, Marty? Have you come across it?
Yes. Lisa Belanger, she's an appellate attorney out in Boston. She's a good friend of mine. Her father got caught in one of these guardianships. He also was an attorney, and his personal attorney who helped him set up his estate is the one who guardianized him, robbing him blind. She filed against this attorney and the people that she works with, including these other public guardians and all this mess. She filed a RICO case. She went. It took her over a year, and she went through all the public. Oh, well, I have a copy of it. It's all on CD. And they challenged first that she submitted it on a CD, and the judge used that discretionary thing and said it'd be better if you did this, you know, on paper. And she said, well, you know, the rules and regulations say I can, if it's large, I can put it on a CD. Well, no, we want it on paper. So she did that. The judge then kicked it back and said it was too verbose. She had spent a year going through public records and had assembled one of the most meticulous cases I have ever seen, and it showed a clear pattern of racketeering. That case was dismissed. The judge never alluded to the fact, when you say they won't let you mention the law, that this was a RICO filing. She had him nailed to the wall. I'm telling you,
she
did.
So it sounds like what they did is they tried to nitpick her using the rules, but they went against their own rules.
Yes.
So the rules that say you can do it electronically, they made an exception for her and told her to do it non-electronically.
Well, then
you know,
it was too
And they will do that, and you'll see the pattern. And you know, if you're experiencing that with a judge, you know you're under fire.
Yep.
You know they're treating you unfairly. And in essence, what they're really doing is they're discriminating against her.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they were doing a systematic kind of court discrimination against her. And that's the kind of case that I would like to try to develop at the Whistleblower Summit this year in July. Will she be there? I would love to meet Lisa and to see her disc, her filings, because it's interesting that when they do abuse of discretion and you end up taking it up on appeal, the trick for the person who lost is to refuse to argue abuse of discretion. You have to have about a 99% sure case before you could ever win anything on abuse of discretion, before you could win an appeal. It just is impractical. It probably is never going to happen. So avoid appealing on that issue. Instead, appeal on the issue of the judge failed to follow the law. This is the law. This is the statute. What's mandatory? Did they have discretion? Does the law say shall, which means they have no discretion? That cuts discretion out. Or does it say may? You know, the judge may do
Carolyn?
This.
They have changed that now. Shall, the Supreme Court ruled this here two and a half years ago, that shall and may basically are the same thing.
Absolutely.
You can do it or you cannot. Yeah. But now
I'm sorry.
You have to use.
So says little peon Carolyn Douglas.
Yeah. But,
says absolutely
but now
not.
You
and
have
I
to use
and I would tell that to the Supreme Court judge.
Well, You have.
I had one as my constitutional law professor, Anthony Kennedy, taught me con law.
Okay, but now you have to use the word must. If the word must is not in there, it's not a command to do something. Because people had found this difference in may and shall. So, of course, we did a weasel word swap, and now you have to use a whole new word. Going back to Lisa's case, every time that judge dismissed, threw her case back at her, never at any time, did she reference the fact that that was a RICO filing. She never alluded to it, mentioned it. It was all this nicky-nacky, the wrong paper, you was on CD, we want paper, it's too many, it's too big, oh, you cut it down, well now, you know, but she never at any time, Carolyn, said, your RICO filing. Never did she mention it one time.
Oh, no, they're going to ignore the wrongdoing, but then they probably, my best guess would be, that Lisa probably is experiencing bar retaliation.
Yes, they have her under investigation now, and they're trying to disbar her.
Yes, under investigation, and they're probably auditing her. Is she a solo practitioner?
Yes, she is. And it's so easy for them
to pick us off. That's part of the panel that I'm putting on at the Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C. We will be July 30th at the U.S. Capitol. And we are in the House Judiciary Investigation Hearing Room in the afternoon. And the retaliation against attorneys who stand up and speak out about all kinds of court corruption, judicial corruption. Mm-hmm. It's not court corruption. It's judicial corruption.
Yes.
It starts at the top. The corruption is at the top. It's taken about 30 years for it to become in full bloom across the entire country, which is, I don't know how you go to court and get justice. It seems like you need to circumvent court if you're going to try to get justice. And
I'm not actually suggesting
vigilantism.
Yeah. Well,
I'm talking about mediation and arbitration and just trying to live the kind of life where you don't end up going to court. If you're going to get divorced, you work out a settlement before you go to court. Yeah.
Well, the whole problem with this is there is a growing movement to disbar the bar associations, make it illegal for them to form. I mean, people are adamant about this. And the second thing is, basically, they want a whole workover of their state-level courts. As far as the Supreme Court goes, in my opinion, and I'm speaking for myself here, I think they have become useless tools, and they should be disbanded as they exist now, and because they are absolutely a threat to the country. This is a clear and present danger they represent.
Are you talking about the Supreme Court, or are you talking about the state bar associations?
Both of them. Both of them, but the Supreme Court being the worst. When you have judges deciding among themselves that they have immunity, and I brought this up before, stare decisis, or however you say that foolish word.
Stare decisis.
Yeah, okay.
Stare decisis, yes.
Well, there were three rulings before the current one by this Supreme Court that judges have immunity. No, they don't. There was three prior Supreme Court rulings that said, no, you do not have immunity. If the common person can't come in there and claim ignorance of the law, you as the expert in the room most assuredly cannot. So they totally, that whole, whatever that stupid combination of words is,
it was out the window. It's an artificial title, a gift that judges waved that wand and gave themselves, judicial immunity. And they did it all about 1900. An awful lot happened in this country in 1900, in the industrial age, just before World War I, and America changed. That was the beginning of this forced bar association movement that really didn't come to fruition until the 70s. And then at that point, it became mandatory in almost every state. And that's the control. And what it did is the judges took authority over lawyers that they never had before. It was always the legislature that regulated every occupation, including lawyers. But once they got control of lawyers, they could use both the carrot and the stick. In other words, they can give appointments, they can give fee approvals, they can award cases, they can extend your case an extra 3 or 4 or 5 years and increase the lawyer fees. So what they're doing is they're feeding the lawyers, but they're making them afraid to criticize this judicial corruption that now has become so rampant across every courtroom in the country. Now, not every judge is corrupt in every case. There isn't cronyism in every case, and I don't mean to say that, but what I'm saying is there is so much cronyism in court that it's like rolling the dice. For you to get a fair hearing at a good price for what you're paying, most consumers are vastly overpaying for justice. And the justice, the reward at the end really goes to the lawyers. It doesn't go to the parties. So it's not a matter of hiring, you know, the biggest, most connected lawyer, although that's part of it. It doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to win. It might mean that they will find out how much money you have, and the case will continue until you run out of funds.
One of the things I've noticed in going through, like, U.S. Code and Title and all of this stuff, there's all sorts of, like, torts, for instance. In these guardianship cases, there is a tort for, you know, intentional interference with inheritance. So here about 3 years ago, Carolyn, I thought, now I wonder why nobody has filed this. And so I started calling various law firms in the Twin Cities, big law firms. And when I found those that would, you know, address something like this, I said, you know, do you handle torts? And told them what it was about and everything. The cost, the retainer alone, the retainer was $75,000. And I said, excuse me? Oh, yeah, you get into one of these and you file this. And I started laughing and I said, well, you must be insane. And what are you possibly going to do that would cost $75,000?
They're going a whole lot of unnecessary. They're going to churn discovery, for one. But they're also going to line up a whole series of experts and have a battle of experts, some of whom are whorish and who will say anything for a fee. And they'll also work real hard. For example, if you look at Massey Cole, which is one of the biggest examples of campaign funding to elect a judge in order to affect a case outcome. Millions in West Virginia case, millions and millions and millions of dollars in order to put a particular judge with a special mindset on the appeal of the Massey Cole case. And I forget how many millions of dollars, but it was historic and record-breaking in order to get a favorable judge, in order to affect the outcome. So it's really like a long-term chess game for corporations. And many of them are willing to spend millions and millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in order to avoid setting a precedent. For example, insulation. You know, that whole asbestos litigation process. It was just amazing how much money it cost to find. That's why class actions began to be developed. But class actions have been so unpopular, and federal judges are setting up a whole series of rules that Lisa may have come across, where they don't let you bring. Hers wasn't a class action, though. Hers was just a RICO case, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Interesting, because RICO kind of got expanded by tort law. So if you can go, that's why tort lawyers are specialty lawyers. They do personal injury usually, and a lot of times they won't even charge you a retainer, but they take 30 to 40% of the recovery.
Yes.
So
yeah,
it's a catch-22.
Yes, either way, you're going to pay through the nose.
So what happened with the case where they wanted to charge you the $75,000 retainer?
Well, I started laughing, and I said, well, I'd have to sell my youngest grandchild to raise that kind of money. And I said, what could you possibly do that would be worth $75,000? And the response was, well, all we have to sell is our information. And I said, excuse me, that's all anyone has to sell, whether it's your mechanic, I said, the person at the store running the cash register, that's all they're selling, is their knowledge about what they're doing. Why would yours be so special? Why would it be so expensive?
What did they say, Marty?
The guy just sat there. He said, I don't think you're understanding me. I said, I understand you clearly. I said, you're planning on raping me financially. I said, with no guarantees that you can win or you will win or you'll even try to win. That's what I'm hearing. You just want that $75,000. And I said, I know how this will go after that. I won't be able to get you on the phone. You'll be busy. You'll call me back in five, and that could be 5 days, 5 months, whatever. And I said, but I will get a bill for $5 for licking a stamp. $500
for answering
the phone.
It's not dissimilar from what's happened in the criminal defense system. If you needed a criminal defense attorney to defend you in trial, and you run around and say, I am innocent and I want to go to trial, what are you going to charge me? And they will tell you, oh, we do that kind of thing all the time. We want $20,000. It's a flat fee. But then what happens is you get 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 2 weeks or a week out from trial, and they haven't done anything.
No.
And that's when they pressure to plea bargain.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, you know what, the chances are, and you really ought to, and you say, wait a minute, remember I'm innocent. I've said all along, and you agreed, and you took my money, and they spent the money, so you fire them. And you ask the court for another continuance, and you hire another defense attorney. Only this one goes, oh, my gosh, we've only got a couple weeks till trial. We'll get a continuance. I need $30,000 as a retainer.
Yes.
So you file a complaint because the first attorney law firm won't give you your money back. They say they spent
no.
it. And then you give the second attorney a retainer. And then the same thing happens. They all refuse, in the end, to prep for trial, to go to trial, and they all pressure you to take the prosecutor's sweetheart deal, which is why across America the statistics are, when I started writing my book, it was about 91 or 92% of all criminal cases were being pled out.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's up to 97%. There are hardly any criminal trials, and yet the defense attorneys don't tell all us poor schmucks who are calling their office saying, I want to take my case to trial because I want to prove I'm innocent. They take the money and run, and they
mm-hmm.
don't ever, and they won't tell you. They'll say, oh, yeah, we'll get ready for trial, and then they don't. So when you don't get your money back through a fee dispute, you don't get a professional conduct complaint against the law firm for, you know, dishonest representation, that doesn't get you anything. I mean, you're left at the end with probably a plea deal, you know, at the very end under extreme pressure because the system is set up that prosecutors actually, I think, have more power in the courtroom than judges do, based on what they decide to charge you with. So they may charge you with 99 different offenses, but they'll plea you out for one.
Yeah.
So you'll end up, you know, and we'll drop it down to one charge if you agree to take 2.5 years or whatever it is, and pay this fine. And you feel like the person you hired to help you, to represent you, just abandons you. They're kind of like, oh, I use this term loosely, but they're similar to hospice care. You know, they're there to hold your hands while you're convicted, while you're
yes.
put in jail, and then they're gone. But the whole entire system seems so dishonest. And I understand why more and more people end up going in pro se. One, they
yes.
can't afford the retainers that are being asked for. And two, the attorneys aren't doing their job. Now, that's part of this whole growth system in giving prosecutors so much power, charging power, and
mm-hmm.
penalty sentencing power. They actually have more power than judges do, because the prosecutors get to decide what. On the other hand, I've also seen a prosecutor take five felonies and reduce them down to one misdemeanor for the child of a very influential, wealthy, important person. So the favors can go out of the prosecutor's office just as well. And it's
yeah.
all based on cronyism. It's not based on what the American system, to me, it's so discouraging. I mean, I love the law. I went to law school and loved learning law and studying law, and I like writing law books. But the disparity between the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, and that's actually the most important probably, and that was signed before the Constitution, and then, of course, the U.S. Constitution. The courts are saying these documents are antiquities that are
yes.
very nice, but they're not relevant.
Right.
Dang, excuse me.
That's why you exist. If they weren't relevant, then there is no reason for you to exist.
They're relevant to us 90% of the people who
yes.
want to rely on them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the joke of going to court, is
yes.
that you can't get the courts to listen to the arguments, to understand or listen to the laws that were passed and are on the books, and instead they've substituted out this judicial discretion that I think
yes.
you and I had quite a lengthy talk about this
yeah.
even before the show. And that's my new pet peeve, because I think that it's just become rampant, and yet it's so hidden from the American
yes.
public. The public doesn't understand. And even when the judge says, because I said so, is the reason you're going to lose, the reason you're going to be convicted, the reason you lost your child or your house or your property, because I said so? I'm sorry. You know, we didn't like Henry a lot when he did that. And when George was king, we revolted.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I'm sorry. Imperialism doesn't sit real well in America. And yet we have an entire branch that's doing it, but they're doing it in private. They're doing it in their own little courtrooms, which are like little fiefdoms of power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have their own bailiffs, and they sit up there on a throne, you know, wearing a robe, and it's they're believing this stuff. They
mm-hmm.
are believing
yes.
in their own infallibility. And then they're covering for each other when it goes up on appeal. So
right.
they give you excuses for why they won't hear or why they won't mention this RICO case. And
mm-hmm.
they may nitpick to create some kind of a procedural. Procedure should never, in the end, triumph over substance. If you have a substantive right, you know, it's on the wrong paper. You didn't put the staples in the right way.
Yeah, oh, I
you
know.
You didn't use the right color on the cover mm-hmm. of your appeal. All of those in where I used to practice in New Hampshire, all of those, they would reject your 8 copies of the appeal that you have struggled for weeks to get together. They fine you $50 for each of the staples that are wrong, and each of
uh-huh.
the colored paper that's wrong, and each of the, you know, minuscule little things, and they reject your appeal. It's like a
mm-hmm.
game to them. It's
mm-hmm.
not your life. It's not your house. It's not, you know, what's important to you. It's not your rights or your job or your entitlements. under the Constitution. It's not that. It's a game. How do we keep these people from filing appeals?
Right. Well, and they don't want you doing anything either. They truly do not. And this thing about pro se's, I've read here recently, it's now up to 80% of all cases filed of any kind across the country are pro se.
You're reading more than I am, because I knew when I wrote the book, 70% of cases across the country have at least one pro se person. And they don't want ordinary people coming to court. That's why they've developed such an elaborate legal system. Now, judges have developed this, and we all buy it because you're so reverential about judges. But for me, that was the nice thing about being married to a judge, a Supreme Court judge, is they put their pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else does, and they're just human beings. I'll never forget Carolyn Sullivan was wife of a judge in New Hampshire, and some of us, the wives, the ex-wives of judges, we sat around and we laughed our heads off one night, because she said shortly after Michael became a judge, he came home and she was wearing jeans. And he said, judges' wives don't wear jeans.
Really?
They are so full of themselves. We used to call it, when my former judge husband became a U.S. congressman, we used to call it Potomac fever.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like when you cross the river, something happens to congressmen who can be decent, respectable, fundamental people, and then they get into Congress and they become entitled. Entitled that their head swells so big, and that's what's happened with the court system, is they've made this little elite branch that really believes their power. And yet I stand back and think, if we have 70 or 80% of people going to court without a lawyer, I think it's because they can't afford it. Why isn't the court system looking at a different kind of justice?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we have neighborhood clinics where you go in and fill out your paperwork and have a different form of justice?
Right.
We don't have to have the system that they have right now. We don't have to have the expensive attorneys that they have right now. That's the system they've set up. But the alternative systems, they're not funding. They're not even thinking of them. They're not even envisioning them, you know, that there could be any other kind of justice except the ones that the courts are practicing now. And they're doing a real disservice to the American public. I mean, to those 80% of people, why are there not, the earlier caller was talking about Agent Orange. And I remember we had a lawyer in my law office who was a Marine, former Marine, and he had suffered Agent Orange. So our office was one of those tort personal injury law offices where we fought for Agent Orange and lost and lost and lost. The government was just so clearly drawing down the curtain and saying, what Agent Orange? We don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
and they're
Carolyn,
suffering
the symptoms. Carolyn, we're down to a minute here.
Oh, my goodness.
This time has flown by. Yeah, we're down to a minute here. I want to thank you for coming on. Thomas, thank you for filling in there at the beginning of the show.
Thomas,
we've got a lot
so
of
much.
Response to this. Carolyn, people want to know. I'll tell you what. I've told people to email me if they want to get in contact with you.
Would you please pass their messages and their comments along? I'd love to hear what they have to say.
Anybody that wants to reach Carolyn, email me at ppj1@hush.com, and I'll get your message to Carolyn, and we'll go from there. I want to thank you, Carolyn, for coming on. Thomas, again, thank you for tuning in. And
Thomas, thank
we
you.
Will, Yeah, we'll be back again next week. And like I say, everybody remember the summit, July 30th and 31st in Washington, D.C. Everybody's welcome.
It's
and
free.
In closing,
it's free, yeah. And it's running a couple of days. It's a great summit.
Yes.
It's all kinds of whistleblower comments, and it's a good place to get a public forum for these things that we're talking about today.
Yes,
if you
is.
Don't understand what happened in 1913, then everything else you understand will only confuse you.
There you go. We've got to close it. Thanks, both of you, and we will be
Thank
back
you,
next week. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.